The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, breathless with the racing that's going on at the moment, and I'm with, I think, an equally breathless Lionel Burney.
Giddy, Richard. Positively giddy.
I was spinning round like a top. You've just come back from Tuscany. You had a lovely weekend away with Simon Gill at the at Strada Bianca, a mini break, documented in the first of two episodes this week. Very evocative it was too, Lionel.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, corrections corners flooding in already. I've had Lizzie Banks on WhatsApp today correcting my pronunciation of Strade Bianche. As I said, in Watford, we tend to flatten all the vowels and really land heavily on the consonants. It's just, unfortunately, that's how I say things. In my head, it sounds lyrical and poetic, but it's obviously not coming out quite right. But
just call it the White Roads next year.
Oh, well, why not? And also, Joe Grant on Twitter, I mentioned Jurgen Klopp's recent quote, Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool football manager, about how football is the most important of the things that don't matter. And he points out, Joe Grant did, that Arrigo Sacchi, the great Milan manager, was the person who apparently said that first. And I wish I'd known that when I was recording, because obviously it's a little bit more poetic to have an Italian as the originator of that particular quote. But I was using it to kind of...
You'd have sounded a bit more learned, wouldn't you? You'd have sounded...
I would have done, yeah, exactly.
Like Daniel.
Like I knew what I was talking about.
Well, of slightly more concern, there's another piece of correspondence from Will Roberts today. Morning all. Really enjoyed the show, the Strada Bianca episode. Just hope Lionel doesn't get into trouble. Every car I've had in Italy strictly forbids use on white roads. Regards, Will Roberts. Thanks for that, Will.
Yeah, thank you. That's I'm just awaiting the call.
Lionel's checking his terms and conditions at the moment.
Yeah, there was a little bit of dust on the car when we dropped it back at the airport on Monday morning. I must admit, they may suspect that we drove it on the white roads. I have to say, if you haven't listened to the episode, hopefully my enthusiasm for the race came across. It was a sort of, not really a race report, it was a bit of a travel log. Hopefully it captured a little bit of the difficulty of covering the race. It was a challenge because I'd never been there before. We were learning very much on the job, and it is a difficult one logistically to cover because, well, the women's race goes out at 9 o'clock in the morning and finishes when the men are out on the course, and not an easy one to cover on the ground. So hopefully people got a flavour of what Tuscany was like at the weekend. But I mean, it wasn't until I watched the highlights I knew really what had happened in either race.
Well, two really interesting different races, weren't they? And the women's race with Lotte Kopecky, what a ride from her, just phenomenal. We're going to catch up with the racing in this episode. After this part, we'll hear from Daniel Freib and me at Paris-Nice, a dispatch from Orléans after the first two stages. So, I mean, two really thrilling and action-packed and intriguing stages to open Paris-Nice. So we'll hear from Daniel and me. We're going back in time a little bit to catch up on those two stages. We'll hear a few interviews there as well, including from Ben O'Connor, who rode extremely well on stage two in the crosswind. Sadly, didn't start today's time trial. He has succumbed to a bit of flu. We are recording now on Wednesday, just after the time trial in Paris-Nice and just after a bunch sprint at Tirreno Adriatico. So we're going to be catching up with Paris-Nice, Tirreno Adriatico, looking back a little bit at Strada Bianca. And in the final part, we're going to look ahead to the new Netflix series, Netflix turning their attention to the Tour de France. It seems like a version of Drive to Survive, their phenomenally successful and popular series covering Formula One. They're taking that treatment to cycling, which is very exciting, I think, for cycling fans, for the sport in general. And we'll hear a little bit from Tom Sutherland, Owain Doull on that as well. Their team, EF Education Easy Post, one of the eight teams going to be part of that. But before all of that, do you have a news roundup, please, Lionel?
Yes, I do, Richard. All the racing first. Strade Bianche at the weekend, won by Tadej Pogacar in really astonishing fashion, wasn't it? Just under 50 kilometres to go when he attacked. We've said he's the Pognomenon. What's Daniel's phrase?
Pogcineration.
Pogcineration. I mean, this was Pogissimo, wasn't it? I mean, he really lit up the white roads and looked very, very impressive, unbeatable almost. Alejandro Valverde, well, he got the he was on the grey roads, I guess, 41 years old. An impressive second place for him. As you said, Richard, the women's race was a humdinger. I mean, Lotte Kopecky, I mean, beating Annemiek van Vleuten in the finish was, well, just the kind of headline, really, because it was a thrilling finale. Ashley Moorman-Passio was third. Pogissimo's win in Italy really has topped an incredible week for UAE Team Emirates, because Matteo Trentin won Le Samin in Belgium ahead of Hugo Hofstetter. Hofstetter really weaved his way through a bit like a sort of dodgem car through the finish, wasn't it, in the sprint, but Trentin held him off to win there. And UAE also swept the podium at Trofeo Laguiglia with Jan Polansch ahead of Alessandro Covi and Juan Ayuso. So certainly in form on several fronts, UAE Team Emirates. The women's edition of Le Samin was won by Emma Norsgaard of Movistar. Then there was another race in Belgium, the Grand Prix Jean-Pierre Monceret, named after the late world champion from the early 1970s. It was won by the young Lotto Soudal rider Arnaud Delis, and Hofstetter was on the podium again there in third place behind Dries De Bont. As I think we mentioned last week, but perhaps it slipped under the radar a bit, Quick-Step are going to be without Tim de Klerk for the Classics. Certainly going to miss the racing in March and probably most of April as well. He's contracted COVID and has pericarditis, so he will be out of action for a little while. Well, as I mentioned in my episode from Tuscany, it was impossible to ignore what's been going on in Ukraine, the conflict there, the invasion by Russia. Well, it's on everybody's minds, isn't it? And it does relate to sport and to the sport of cycling. There's some political machinations going on that I'll talk about at the end of the episode today, but a couple of things that relate to the sport. The Gazprom team has been suspended. They wanted to ride the Trofeo Laguiglia in plain white jerseys, but their bike sponsors Look and other sponsors had withdrawn support, and the team has been suspended from racing. The Drone Hopper team, that's Gianni Savio's team, arrived at the sign-on in Ukrainian tribute jerseys at Trofeo Laguiglia. They have the Ukrainian champion Andrei Ponomar riding for them, but he wasn't taking part in that particular race. And Pavel Sivakov has switched nationality from Russian to French. This is something he'd wanted to do for some time, but the process has been fast-tracked by the UCI as a result of the situation between Russia and Ukraine. Sivakov was born in Italy and grew up in France, but his parents are both Russian. Alexei Sivakov, who raced for the French Big Mat team for a few years around the turn of the century, and Alexandra Kolyaseva, who won two team time trial world titles for Russia and won the Tour de l'Aude and was second in the women's Giro. As I say, some impact regarding the European Cycling Union and the UCI. That's the world governing body, but I'll talk about that at the end of the episode. And finally, some very sad news. Dean Woods passed away, aged 55, from cancer. If you, like me, remember the 1986 Commonwealth Games, he was one of the stars of the show, wasn't he, Richard? He won two gold medals on the track and a silver. He also won team pursuit gold at the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984 and a handful of other Olympic medals in Seoul, I think it was, wasn't it, 1988? Mm. So sad news that Dean Woods passed away. And finally, there's a story to be dug into regarding the Astana team, who have not been paid, apparently, for January and February. Velo News have done some good reporting on this so far. This is, of course, a team state-owned and funded. There's been political uncertainty in Kazakhstan since the start of the year, hasn't there? And that is having a knock-on effect for the cycling team as well. We're going to be talking a lot about the racing at Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico in this week's episode. For the first time that I can ever remember, they finish on the same day. Normally they overlap rather than sort of clash directly like they do this way. Ciro mentioned that the reason for Tirreno's date change is just to have the final stages held over the weekend, and that frees up a slot for For Milano-Torino in the middle of next week before Milan-San Remo next weekend, the first of the monuments. I mean, what can you say about the racing in Paris-Nice? Stage one was an absolute humdinger, wasn't it? In the crosswinds, a Jumbo-Visma 1-2-3, Christophe Laporte ahead of Primoz Roglic and Wout van Aert. The three riders finished clear of everybody else after breaking clear on the finishing circuit with around 6 kilometres to go, wasn't it? The finish picture ruined only by the fact that Roglic was in long trousers, I was going to say, bib tights or leg warmers.
Yeah, if ever there was a sign that, you know, Roglic is sort of not yet at his absolute best, the sight of him riding away from everyone wearing tights.
Oh, amazing, isn't it? Yeah. And then more crosswinds on stage two. It did all come back together, and Fabio Jakobsen won his sixth race of the 2022 season ahead of Van Aert and Laporte. There's a theme developing here, isn't there? Stage three, Mads Pedersen, who pulls off these sprint wins, doesn't he, every now and again, got ahead of Bruin Coquart and Van Aert again. And as you said, Richard, the time trial today, Ben O'Connor was out with flu. He was riding high overall. Max Schachmann, who's won the last two editions, also pulled out with illness. But Wout van Aert, I mean, it was another Jumbo-Visma masterclass, wasn't it? He pips Roglic and takes over the leader's jersey. Laporte did a fantastic ride and is still holding a podium position at the moment. The other impressive rides were by Rohan Dennis, who led for a lot of the day before the Jumbo-Visma riders started arriving. And Simon Yates as well, who, as the climbing stages come along later on in the week, he put in a fantastic ride on the time trial. And as time trials go, I thought it was a good one with that uphill finish at the end. Good to watch. Meanwhile, over in Italy, that kicked off with a time trial won by Filippo Ganna ahead of Remco Evenepoel, Tadej Pogacar and Kasper Asgreen. It was Alex Dowsett who had led for a long while, but he eventually finished fifth. And the subsequent two stages have both ended in sprint finishes. Tim Merlier of Alpecin Fenix yesterday. Sorry, it's Alpecin De Koninck now, isn't it, I think? Or is it Alpecin?
No, Alpecin Fenix.
It's still Alpecin Fenix, but they have De Koninck as a co-sponsor, don't they? He won yesterday, and today, I mean, if you just looked at the headline and saw that Caleb Ewan won for Lotto Soudal, you'd assume it was a fairly, uneventful day. But there was this extraordinary move by Tadej Pogacar and his teammate Marc Soler, kicked off by Julian Alaphilippe, the world champion. Theo Gegenhardt joined them, and we had these four riders who really made the sprinters teams work very hard to bring it all back together. Still 4 days to go in both races, and next week we will more than likely, I think we've decided, this editorial conference has decided, we'll do one episode on Paris-Nice and one episode on Tirreno-Adriatico, also looking ahead at Milan-San Remo. So another week with two episodes next week.
And the final item in the news, Lionel, is that next week we'll also be launching a new show, Arrivé. We will be, throughout the spring, bringing you instant, more or less, instant reaction, analysis, discussion from the big races. And the first one of those is the first monument of the season, Milan-San Remo. So Lionel, Daniel and I will be on hand, and you should have that in your ears as soon as possible after the finish.
I mean, we've got cycling covered, haven't we? We have Kilometre Zero at the Grand Tours. Now we have Arrivé for the big one-day races. I mean, it's
just
only a matter of time
we don't really pay attention to.
Only a matter of time before I launch the feed zone, of course, to go out. Oh. I don't know, maybe sometime in the middle of the week. Just be all about food.
The Cycling Podcast. Powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thanks very much to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. Grateful to them for their support. Now, I caught up last week with their founder and chief executive, Phil Sutherland, to find out how things are going with Super Sapiens a year after they launched.
We talked last year a lot about, you know, any human's an athlete. And, you know, so, but we've kind of taking that a step back to really focus on, you know, who do we want to serve? And it's our belief at Super Sapiens that anyone with a goal is an athlete. And so that really yields into, you know, what is your goal? Right. And so, you know, how people have used the product, you know, 79% of our users have changed their nutrition habits due to the app insights. 67% feel they can go faster, stronger for longer. 36% of people have noticed a change in their body weight or composition. And, you know, and then 50% of the users, you know, are now fueling a lot more because of the data they've seen on the app. So it's just fun to see how people have used it. And that's going to help us narrow our focus for how we help people on a going forward basis.
That was Phil Sutherland. Thanks once again to Super Sapiens for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I was at Paris-Nice for the first couple of stages. And on the third day in the morning, I caught up with Daniel Freib. And we discussed those very eventful first two stages. And you'll hear a few interviews in this segment as well. So here we are in Orléans, me and Daniel. Well, I'm in a very early morning in Orléans with swimming instructor Daniel Freib. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
It was a shocking revelation last night, wasn't it?
Learning new things about you all the time. Unfortunately, won't have a chance here at Paris-Nice to do any swimming.
to work on your breaststroke.
There was, never mind water, there was a lot of wind yesterday, wasn't there? That must have been a tough day for you.
Well, it's typical Paris-Nice, isn't it? First few days of Paris-Nice, they've become, I suppose they were always notorious to a certain extent for crosswinds, but the ASO have leaned into this, haven't they? Because we were talking last night about how Paris-Nice for a long time finished in, it started in a place called Nevers, which was a long way south of Paris. And I think I heard yesterday that, is it the 13th year that they've had an agreement with the Yvelines, which is the sort of suburbs around to the south of Paris, and since the race has started there, it's had further to travel to get to the south, and that means more days across this sort of breadbasket in the middle of France with no, you know, no protection from the wind on a lot of the roads. And consequently, we don't just get one day of crosswinds, but in this edition, for example, we're probably going to get three, and it's a lot.
Brilliant, isn't it? Wow. I mean, we've seen two very exciting days of racing. We're going to talk briefly about Strade Bianche later, but that already seems like a long time ago. Stage one here at Paris-Nice, a lot of people were expecting a bunch sprint, a lot of good sprinters here, but Jumbo-Visma really ripped it up, didn't they? And three of them came to finish. Christophe Laporte, I mean, the way they set up was fantastic. Very narrow roads, quite tricky. They really strung it out on the approach to a pretty short climb, 1 kilometre long, 6%, nothing really. Nathan van Hooijdonk, who was very impressive on opening weekend, again, really, you know, riding in a way that we haven't really seen him ride before. And he set up for Christophe Laporte, who was also very impressive. I mean, seeing Laporte here in Jumbo-Visma colours reminds me a bit of seeing Lotta Kopecky for her new team SD Works. It's a rider who's been good and been, you know, capable of winning races, but seems to have just raised their level moving to a better team.
Yeah, Laporte's, I mean, he's someone who came into road racing pretty late. He was a mountain biker. And even when he arrived at Cofidis and started getting good results a few years ago, people were kind of surprised because he wasn't someone who'd been heavily touted. And then he got sort of pigeonholed as a lead-out man, didn't he, with Buani. And that he could have remained as a lead-out man had he not sort of fallen out with Buani and actually almost usurped him. There was that famous, was it Rue du Sud, where their relationship deteriorated over a few days, and he was sort of emancipated to a certain extent after that and started getting his own chances as a sprinter. But he's always looked strong on a variety of different courses, hasn't he? And by all accounts, everyone's been really impressed with him since he joined there in the closed season. I mean, he's been talking about the altitude camp that they all did, the long altitude camp, and how hard the team worked, and you can kind of see that here. But Laporte also stayed longer than the rest of the team, I think, because he got COVID and this left him a bit behind schedule. So I think he stayed there, was it in Sierra Nevada? No,
it was in Tenerife.
He was in Tenerife, yeah. Right up until, I think, the eve of Het Nieuwsblad.
That's right. I mean, it was an interview in L'Équipe, wasn't it, last week? Mm. And you got a sense from that, without him being critical of Cofidis, but you got a real sense of the difference in the commitment required at Jumbo Visma. And he was talking about wanting to have his family there for at least some of these altitude camps, because they're going away for 3 weeks. And then before a three-week race, it's a long time away. So there was a real sense from that of the level that he's required to be at also raising. And we can see, I mean, it was a fantastic performance. He's still in the yellow jersey here. But a 1-2-3 for Jumbo Visma. And I spoke to their sports director, Frans Maassen, at the end. Interesting, when I asked him if he'd ever seen such a performance before, he mentioned the unmentionable, but we'll hear that now.
I think most of us thought it was going to be a bunch sprint today. Did you, or did you have other ideas? What was it, the wind? What prompted the sort of change in strategy?
Yeah, of course, it was very technical, the last kilometers. We did yesterday the reckon of this stage, and we came to the conclusion that it would be really difficult for the wheel sprinters to be in a bunch sprint. And we expected maybe a group of 30, 40 riders, which would be good for a Wout. But the plan was to attack the last climb with Nathan in front, and then Christophe, and then see what's happening. And then in a certain time they were gone. And yeah.
What did you think when you saw, I mean, Stibar held on for a bit, but when you saw a three-man breakaway and all three riders being from your team, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, unbelievable. Unbelievable. It was the plan to attack there, but not. Yeah, we could not think that three of us would go.
Have you seen that before?
Long time ago on Muir van Hooy.
Yeah, we remember that. But this was a bit different. I mean, you've obviously got overall ambitions here. How did you decide what should be the order across the line? Because I guess time bonuses may be important.
Yeah, from the car view was maybe the best that Christophe would win, but they had to decide themselves.
Is it a welcome gift to Christophe?
Also, but for the next days they can go out and Primoz can go in the bus and take it easier, more. They have more rest than Christophe now.
You mentioned Nathan, and we saw him last weekend as well, play a really important role. I mean, you've got a very strong team, but he seems to have stepped up a lot this year.
Yeah, also Rowan did a really good job, and it was important teamwork today, and it was not only the win of Laporte, but it was a win of the team.
Well, that's Frans Maassen, the sports director at Jumbo Visma. Everyone very happy there. It's interesting he volunteered Gouis, because it's a now notorious performance, isn't it? A 1-2-3 for them at Flèche Wallonne in 94. It was really, it heralded the end of their Italian doctor, Dr. Ferrari, wasn't it? Because that was the performance that really raised eyebrows skywards.
Yes, Richard, and I happen to be drinking a glass of orange juice now. There was a famous reference to orange juice in that quote, wasn't
careful
it?
Careful now, Daniel. It's yeah. Very dangerous.
I'm surprised if I drink 10 litres only. I'm surprised Frans Maassen didn't also mention a stage from Paris-Nice, in fact, because his team's current team, Jumbo-Visma's precursor, was Rabobank, as most people know. And in 1999, second stage of Paris-Nice, Rabobank absolutely tore up the race in crosswinds, and they had 7 of the top 10, and they effectively killed the race. I think 11th place came in 2 minutes down, but they didn't win the stage. Andre Schmil, who we talked about in the podcast last week, didn't we, won the stage.
Yesterday's stage as well, Daniel, we're speaking on Tuesday morning, in fact. Yesterday's stage, the crosswind stage, another belter, a really exciting stage, and a win for Fabio Jakobsen. We didn't maybe see as many casualties in the end in terms of GC, but, you know, Roglic looks ahead of the time trial on Thursday in a really strong position, obviously, after taking that time on day one. You get sad when there are crosswinds on, so I'm sure there's a lot of sadness yesterday, but was there anything significant that happened in terms of the race to the race away from the sun as it is this year?
I mean, not too many big names of casualties, really. There were a lot of guys who looked as though they might be cut adrift badly at one point, you know, like Jack Haig, Simon Yates, Guillaume Martin, and I mean, as I say, the majority of the big hitters sort of limited their losses in the end, or indeed didn't incur any losses. But I think, you know, one sort of tantalizing talking point we've got as we go towards the time trial is how far Wout van Aert is going to be allowed to carry his general classification challenge. I mean, Thursday's stage is already arguably the hardest stage in the race, maybe even harder than the summit finish on the Turini at the weekend. So that may already give us our answer on that score. But it's difficult to see. Well, it's difficult to see who else is going to challenge Roglic, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, it has to be said, the Jumbo-Visma have got the strongest team here on paper. We'll return to that and the performance on Sunday in a moment. But one rider who did impress in the crosswinds, Ben O'Connor, the Australian AG2R, fourth at Tour de France last year. He was very happy with how the crosswinds stage went. Here he was at the finish in Orléans.
A hard day. I mean, that, well, a good day for you, I guess, but pretty frantic out there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm stoked. It's the first time I made pretty much first echelon in a proper big race. So, yeah, I can just be happy with how today went. It was a bit sketchy, though, but...
What do you put that down to? Is it, I mean, you must have been prepared. We could see how strong the wind was. Were you just making sure you were in the right place? Did you have some help from Oliver or anything like
that? Yeah, I mean, the boys are perfect today. I think... Dorian at the start actually was really, really helpful when I actually was not in good position. And then it's just about not panicking and then trusting guys like Ollie Narsen and Sten de Wolf, and it was perfect. So I can only just be really, really pleased with how today went.
You sound almost quite zen, like it was quite relaxed.
Well,
either.
I think it's just like relief that's now pretty much sunk in, which is the best thing. It was nervous going into today, so... It just gives yourself a good chance to finish up there on the GC.
I guess you've got the number one on your back. You know, you're the team leader here after your season last year. More pressure, more responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, it's what you sign up for when you finish fourth in the Tour de France. I mean, there's you can't really beat around the bush. This is just now what my cycling world's going to be like, and hopefully I can perform like I did last year from now on.
Does it also mean that you can sort of prepare in your own way for the Tour, knowing that that's probably your biggest objective of the year?
Yeah, I think I said this to a few people just upon reflection. You've now kind of made the step, so it doesn't feel like you're searching for what you can be or what you should be like or what kind of rider you are. Now, I know I can finish at the top of races. You know, winning something like this is pretty outrageous. I think that would be extremely difficult, but at least I know I can be up there with the best guys, and you can actually plan for that rather than planning to say, oh look, are you actually going to be good here or not?
So today, I guess, another day in your education and your experience as a stage race rider.
Yeah, I said that to Daniel this morning. I was like, today is a day to learn before Denmark, and yeah, it went well.
Now, Daniel, I was joking earlier on when Frans Madsen mentioned Gewiss, and that's an obviously notorious reference point for this sport. We've got that performance. We've had some incredible performances in the last couple of weeks from UAE Team Emirates as well. Jumbo-Visma and UAE Team Emirates seem on a different level. And there have been inevitably some questions that one of our listeners wrote in saying that, you know, could he believe in, you know, Pogacar riding everyone off his wheel with 50 kilometers to go at Strada Bianca, and then Jumbo-Visma managing this 1-2-3 at Paris-Nice. It's inevitable, isn't it? But those two teams do look at the moment like they're on a different level. Someone who works in the sport for one of the teams joked yesterday, asked me what Ineos was Latin for. Was it anonymous, he said, because they, you know, they've suddenly, without Egan Bernal, who's obviously missing, you know, they look like an ordinary team, as all the other teams do, really. Maybe with the exception of Quickstep.
Yeah, I think I would reserve judgment on Ineos in this race until the weekend, because yesterday they were good. Luke Rowe was really good in the crosswinds, and Yates and Danny Martinez were pretty much on his wheel the whole time. So I think, as I say, Roglic looks almost unassailable, but... a decent challenge at least should come from them. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, haven't we, how wealth begets kind of more wealth and resources in cycling, and you know, the best teams can attract or maintain the richest sponsors and give themselves more and more spending power, and that's what's happened with UAE. I mean, we've gone from thinking that was actually quite a a weak team behind an extraordinary young leader not very long ago, sort of 18 months ago, and since then they've signed riders like Almeida, Soler, and then they've had, you know, other riders who have just improved, and all of a sudden they do look like a bona fide super team, don't they?
They had a bad day yesterday though. Almeida and Brandon McNulty did not have a good day, so they're not infallible at all. We watched Strade Bianche on Saturday, of course, and that extraordinary performance from Tadej Pogacar. What were your thoughts? Not perhaps the gripping race that it was last year, but obviously instead of a thrilling race with a galaxy of stars, we saw one absolutely superlative performance, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, on Saturday night when I arrived at Paris-Nice, I went to see Max Schachmann, the defending champion of Paris-Nice, interview him, and we were just chatting about what he'd seen because he'd been glued to it in the afternoon. And it just, I suppose, speaking to other riders and getting a sense of their kind of awe is maybe the best measure of how impressive it was. And just the sort of dynamics of the attack, the moment when Pogacar went away, and just the audacity not to just put in an acceleration, look back, and to see, you know, how much damage you'd done or he'd done, and then maybe to sort of sit up when he realised that the bunch hadn't split, and then go again in a kilometre or so. He was a dog with a bone, wasn't he, for 2 or 3 minutes. And obviously, physiologically, that takes something quite extraordinary to be able to, I mean, I don't know how many watts he was putting out over 5 or 6 minutes, but in order to open up that gap on a part of the course, which I know in the past has been sort of strategic, and I think Pogacar talks about this after the finish, but it doesn't obviously lend itself to just the strongest rider automatically pulling away, does it?
No, but it was a race he rode last year. He was in that group, but, you know, probably learned a lot riding that. And there was a moment where it looked like he was maybe coming back a bit. The group behind was chasing him. But I think we saw in the reaction of the riders, not just here, but there as well. I mean, Valverde looked as happy finishing second as he's ever looked winning a race. And there was a sense from some of the other riders, as I guess there maybe was in Marx's day, and, you know, there's that name again, that comparison again, but you get the sense that other riders are almost feel privileged in a way to be racing in the Pogacar era, because there's a sense now, you know, he's won. We haven't seen this for many, many years, a rider who, you know, it's a favourite for the Tour de France again, but riding as he is now in early March, turning up, winning these races, now he'll target Milan-San Remo and the Tour of Flanders. And I think now we think, well, those are within his reach, probably.
Yeah, and I think the most frightening thing, as we've said, and as I've said a few weeks ago, is just this air of sort of insouciance, this sort of nonchalance that he has, that there's no sense of weight, of pressure, of burden, of, you know, whether that's coming from scrutiny from the outside, the media, or the scrutiny of his position or expectations from his team. You know, yesterday I saw pictures of him moments before rolling off the ramp in Tirreno, sort of doing selfies and, you know, posing for fans and so on. And, you know, that in the past, that has been a major buffer against the domination of certain riders, or against incredible talents, or it's been, you know, something that's really scuppered a lot of riders on their route to what seemed like a kind of inevitable domination. And with Pogacar, it just doesn't seem, there isn't a hint of that at this point. It may yet come, but I don't think it will anytime soon.
There was an extraordinary moment as well on his approach to Siena just before he began the climb, where he high-fived his first coach, one of his one of the people who runs his Poggi cycling team, pointed out on Twitter that was his first coach. Amazing. You'd have the presence of mind to see him and to acknowledge him in that way. I spoke to his UAE Team Emirates teammate, Matteo Trentin, who won GP Samin last week, so he's been contributing to that success that they've had at the start yesterday, about the team, the level they're at, and Pogacar himself. Here is Matteo Trentin.
Matteo, we saw yesterday a real show of strength from Jumbo-Visma. We've seen that from your team as well the last couple of weeks. A lot of people talking about your two teams being a level above the others. Is that how you feel as well? Is that how you see it?
What I feel is that this level of cycling is increasing every year, and I think we made a really good winter. And yeah, the team came really prepared and really motivated to do well. And actually, this month, February, for us was really, really good.
And did you just put that down to winter preparation?
I mean, it's a lot of things coming together. Like from my personal point of view, I normally do like a cross-country ski training camp in during Christmas time. Last year, because of the weather, wasn't possible to do it like 100%. This year, I could do it 100%, and you can see there is a little bit of a gain through now. So then training camp in January, good weather all the time, and not sickness, and the level is so high that every single little detail that makes a huge difference when you come to the races.
What did you make of Pogacar's performance on Saturday? I guess nothing he does surprises us, but
he keeps surprising everybody. Like when he went, I said, "Oh shit, that's a long thing." At one moment, I think he was a little bit too. He aimed a little bit too high to go solo from there, but he keep up really, really good. They shaved at 30 seconds when Asgreen went on the hard climb, but from there on, the gap mainly remained the same. So it was really an impressive performance.
Can he win Milan-San Remo?
I think he can win anything at the moment.
You know the Tour of Flanders well. I guess he can win the Tour of Flanders as well.
I don't know. I mean, it's a different kind of racing. But I won't be surprised.
And what did you make of yesterday? Did you see that coming? Did you suspect it wouldn't be a sprinter stage?
Yeah, we went to see the climb, and I was kind of sure that someone would do something that Jumbo-Visma did. They did it in actually great style. And also the execution of the preparation of the attack they did was actually perfect. So, I mean, chapeau to them. When you can perform something like this, you just have to say congrats to the guy who did it.
Well, Daniel, I'll leave you on your way to Nice. What are you looking forward to for the rest of this week, apart from the crosswinds?
Well, it's kind of an upside-down Paris-Nice in terms of the weather, at least going by the forecast, isn't it? Because we might get some rain at the weekend. It's just going to be interesting to see how, particularly these sort of mixed stages, so Thursday in particular, and then there's another one at the weekend, stages which are difficult to interpret, difficult to read, going by the profile, because, you know, they could turn into huge sort of slugfest between the best climbers and the race being sort of decided, as the French say, à la pédale, or there could be some interesting tactical scenarios, particularly, you know, we've sort of almost written off Ineos, but if Yates stays up there, Martinez stays up there, they've got a couple of cars to play. There are a couple of other teams, or a few other teams, you know, Bora, Hansgrohe, I mean, they haven't had a very happy start to the race with Vlasov and Schachmann, but that might liberate them to try something a little bit different, a little bit quirky. And, well, as we've seen before, Rog,
I mean,
is Schachmann fallible.
Specializes in winning this race in quirky circumstances,
well, exactly,
doesn't he?
Exactly.
To say the least. Well, Daniel, bon route.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Well, I'm back with Lionel now, having left Daniel behind at Paris-Nice. And we've been catching up with the latest stages of Paris-Nice and also Tirreno-Adriatico, of course. In the interview there with Matteo Trentin of UAE Team Emirates, I asked him about his team's supremacy, along with Jumbo-Visma. I mean, at Paris-Nice, it's all been all about Jumbo-Visma, of course. 2-1-2-3s in the opening stages. And I mentioned an email that we got from a listener. The email came from Nathan Long. And he asks if we'd be addressing the amazing form of the weekend. I desperately want to believe that this is a clean sport, but the weekend showing is a little unnerving. I work in the investment industry. There's a phrase that we tend to watch out for as an early warning indicator. This time it's different. I think you could apply this to cycling right now. Riding a whole peloton off your wheel or three riders from the same team going away in any other era, alarm bells would be ringing. Well, clearly alarm bells are ringing for you, Nathan, so I don't think it's confined to other eras. And I mean, you refer there to Pogacar at Strade Bianche as well, of course. I mean, as Daniel said when I asked him about this, wealth begets wealth, and we have in Jumbo-Visma and UAE Team Emirates, as I put it to Matteo Trentin, two teams that are at, you know, currently the best two in the world. You know, Paris-Nice is perhaps not, it's not the strongest field. We have this crazy situation where we've got two World Tour stage races going on at the same time. And, you know, Wout van Aert, Primoz Roglic, two of the best riders in the world. Christophe Laporte is riding at a new level for him. Although, speaking to one or two sports directors and other teams, Matt White and Tom Southam, they're not surprised at all to see Laporte riding as he's riding this week at Paris-Nice, because he's always been capable of it, and they've seen flashes of it in the past. And sometimes when a rider moves to a new team, as with Lotte Kopecky, as I mentioned there, you know, being surrounded by better riders brings a rider on. We see that in other sports as well, don't we? Footballers who go to good football teams become better footballers. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can answer that question at the moment. All we can do is keep our eye on what's going on and keep our ear to the ground. It's no great surprise. I mean, we spoke over the winter about UAE Team Emirates and their recruitment. They've bought up an awful lot of the best riders in the world.
Yeah, I mean, if you take today's time trial, if you said before the start that the top three would be Wout van Aert, Primoz Roglic and Rohan Dennis, there would, no eyebrows would be raised about that, would they? I mean, it's they're all extremely good time trialists, and it just so happens that they ride for the same team. That doesn't mean that it's not a question to be asked, but I do think that this developing theme is of a sort of handful of teams collecting, almost sort of Panini sticker-like, strength in depth, building on already strong teams and adding to them. And there's a real kind of, a sort of top four, isn't there, in the World Tour of teams that don't just have one or two stars, they have four or five. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I suppose, you know, this is the hors d'oeuvre part of the season, isn't it? We've got Paris-Nice going on at the same time as Tirreno-Adriatico, and all the best riders are split roughly evenly between the two races, and it's a case of just spotting and looking at the form and seeing. It would be fascinating to know how they're all going against one another, but that's the whole point of the season kind of being split into these two lanes as we lead into the first big classic, Milan-San Remo, where we will see all of the best riders in the world go head-to-head against one another for the first time, really, in the season. So, yeah, I get the point, but both Jumbo-Visma and UAE Team Emirates have really taken the team building on another level over the last couple of winters, haven't they? Just adding ever stronger riders to their lineups, and we're seeing that in the results. And it's the strength in numbers, isn't it? The other teams, even Ineos Grenadiers, are, you know, trying to fight it with one or two riders. When you think that you know, some of the smaller teams, it's the case that, you know, Pierre Latour, for example, you know, he's there. The sort of him, Simon Yates, they're riding for teams where they're really the only hope of a high overall finish. Whereas in a race like Paris-Nice, you could see Wout van Aert winning it this week. I mean, why not? He's the sort of Sean Kelly of the modern era, isn't he, at the moment?
Yeah. Absolutely, definitely could. I mean, a couple of, we'll move on to Tirreno Adriatico in a moment, because we obviously talked quite a lot about Paris-Nice in the last segment. One thing we didn't mention in the last segment was the performance of Nairo Man, Nairo Quintana, and the crosswinds yet again. That guy is unbelievable, the way that he rides in the crosswinds. He was there without any teammates, but a brilliant performance from him. Unfortunately, he ruined it all with his time trial today, so he kind of slipped away a bit from the, you know, contention for overall. He lost 1:17, I think, today, down 54th. So, you know, not a great day for Quintana in the time trial, but a very good day for Simon Yates. And I spoke quite a bit to Matt White at the at Paris-Nice over the first couple of days, and you know, they had high hopes for Dylan Groenewegen, and Simon Yates. I mean, Groenewegen had mechanical problems on stage two, unfortunately. But Yates, a very, very strong performance today after a bit of an up and down day on the crosswind stage. The group in the crosswind stage, he was on the wrong end of a split at one point, and Matt White said that in a group of the size that it was, which was 50 or 60 riders, you've got to keep riding through, as Quintana was, and not try and sit on the wheels, because that's when you get in trouble. You've got to just commit to it, and it's actually easier and certainly safer. Tangent, but I went and met Marc Sergent last week in Belgium, former Lotto Soudal manager, and he was talking about crosswinds, and he said the best wheel to sit on is a nervous, strong rider, because a nervous, strong rider sits just out from the gutter and offers a lot of shelter. And he's talking about his early days as a pro when he was a nervous, strong rider. And after a couple of years, another rider came up to him and said, "You used to be a great wheel to sit on, but you're not anymore because you're not so nervous." So interesting little bit of insight. But yeah, Simon Yates pretty well positioned in Paris-Nice, but who can see beyond Jumbo-Visma there? And it could be Van Aert or Roglic. Roglic, if he takes his tights off, you know, he could easily win that. But Van Aert is looking extremely good for Paris-Nice as well. Anything from Tirreno, Lionel, that's caught your eye, apart from the buns on buns? I have to credit Kate Wagner with that, but the Iolo team are sponsored by Burger King, and they have a very lifelike depiction of what did Burger King's do? Not a Whopper.
What
did Burger King's do? It is a Whopper. Yeah. They've got a Whopper on their backsides. She called it buns on buns, and it's quite strange.
Yeah, it's well, I noticed it at the weekend actually, on the Aolo jerseys, but also, as you say, it's on the back of the shorts, isn't it? And you know, we're staying in Florence, not really the place that you want a craving for a Burger King, is it? With all that lovely food.
Well, I don't know if it did it. I don't think seeing a picture of it on their bottoms has given me much of a craving, to be perfectly honest.
No.
There you go. We're talking about it, so it's a success.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. No, what caught the eye? I mean, today's stage was fantastic, and it was just one of those days when, again, I'm kind of wondering why the racing is the way it is at the moment. I mean, Alaphilippe, you know, there are chances later in the week for him to, you know, make some gains here or there. It's going to be difficult in a race like this up against Pogacar and others, but just racing for the sake of racing. And I think, you know, we've had years when it's all felt quite controlled and cautious, and people keeping their powder dry for bigger objectives further down the road. But we're seeing racing every day, aren't we? In on all fronts, and it's great to see. It makes you look at the race profiles of the stages and think, maybe today will be a little bit quiet. Just have it on in the background and pay attention at the end. But that's a dangerous assumption to make at the moment, especially when you see the types of riders that reacted so smartly to Alaphilippe as they were going towards that intermediate sprint, wasn't it, on a slightly uphill section. And seeing the four of them away, Theo Gegenhardt joined Pogacar, Soler and Alaphilippe. As I said earlier, Mikel Landa tried to make it across but didn't quite get there and got caught. And it really made the sprinters' teams work, and they probably will benefit from that sort of chase. I mean, it disrupted, gave them a different challenge to think about. You know, they're sort of, perhaps that's what it's all about, simulating Milan-San Remo, sort of 10 days away from it.
Yeah, I mean, it was very good to see Theo Gegenhart riding across to that group, which was no mean feat, and a very, really good sign from him that he's finding some form. That was impressive. Arnaud Démare was impressive as well at the finish, I thought. I think it was Jacopo Guarnieri who led him out, and really difficult finish over these little cobbles. You could see the wheels skipping about a lot. And Démare looked like he had it. Really, would have been a really important win for him, but Caleb Ewan very quick in the end. The only thing I wonder about, and it goes for Van Aert as well, is that these races, Paris-Nice and Trenitalia, can also, if you ride the way that Pogacar rode today, might it, affect his ability to be in the top form for Milan-San Remo, as it did with Mathieu van der Poel last year, and arguably with Van Aert as well last year?
Well, yeah, I think the change of date maybe means that they need to go a bit deeper, a bit harder. It's a little bit further out, isn't it? The race normally would finish on the Tuesday before Milan-San Remo, and instead it's finishing on the Sunday. And with, as we've talked in the past, the big debate about whether or not Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico is the better preparation for Milan-San Remo, it's a sort of moot question now, isn't it? Because they both finish at the same time, so it comes down to more the style of racing and the course rather than the proximity to Milan-San Remo. But I wonder whether that's something to do with it. Having some hard days out now, 10 days before, perhaps it's preferable to having some hard days out sort of 6-7 days before. I don't know. In the sprints, I should mention Olaf Kooi, the young Dutch rider, another Jumbo-Visma rider getting up there. He's been I think second and third in the two sprints so far. And the other thing that caught my eye in the time trial, it's caught a lot of people's eyes, I think, was Filippo Ganna being basically having 21 spare bikes on the car, following car behind
him, like a double decker bus behind him.
And the suggestion is that this is it's creating a bit of a tunnel effect for him. We know that go back to the 1995 Tour de France when Chris Boardman was trying to win the prologue in Brittany, and the approach was for the team car to drive as close to his back wheel as possible, because as I understand it, Richard, you might know a bit more about this, I'm no aerodynamicist, but by having an object behind you,
think I am
you might have read a bit more or talked to people a bit more about this, but this is how I remember it. By having the car right behind the rider, you're kind of not having the same bit of drag from, just having dead air behind the riders. So, this is a new trend, isn't it? Sort of 100 well, and yeah. something thousand euros worth of spare bikes on the car.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually, Boardman spoke about it to me in relation to 94, the prologue there as well, having the car as close as possible behind him, which did almost cost him his leg a year later in those terrible conditions in Brittany. But he's spoken about that before, and obviously that's a long time ago, so it's been known about for a long time, but I haven't seen that before. Corrections corner, it wouldn't have been Guarnieri, because he was the wrong side of a little split today. I think it was Tobias Ludvigsen, his lead out man, Arnaud Démare's lead out man in Tirreno Adriatico today. But it was good to see Démare competitive again, because it's been a while really since he's been able to be at the front in a race of that level, World Tour race like that. So that was good to see. Lionel, we heard in the last part from Matteo Trentin, who won Le Samen last week, and I was there, and I wrote about this in the 11:01 Cappuccino last week. But Daniel Manjas was there, the old Tour de France commentator for many, many years, the voice of the tour, the voice that you would hear at stage starts and finishes as a kind of soundtrack to what was going on. And it was an absolute delight to find him in the tiny little square at the start of Le Samen, his voice booming across the village, really. I thought I'd reintroduce Slow Radio and have Daniel Manjas, the old voice of the tour. He stopped in 2014, and for me, the Tour de France isn't quite the same without his voice. He doesn't do many races anymore. He used to do 200 a year, but But it was great to hear him at Les Salmons. So here he is, Daniel Monjas.
Digne évidemment de l'équipe que nous accueillons sur le podium maintenant. Vos applaudissements, l'équipe Lotto-Soudal. L'équipe avec notamment donc Cédric Valens, deuxième du Tour des Flandres Espoir. On retrouve également l'homme qui a fait deuxième de Paris-Roubaix, Florian Vermersch, deuxième de Paris-Roubaix. On retrouve également Frédéric Frison, qui a brillé au championnat de Belgique, Arnaud Dely, qui a brillé à Etiusblad, et sur les routes espagnoles, Brett Van Boer, champion de Belgique contre la montre, vainqueur au Dauphiné, le multiple champion d'Europe, recordman du monde de l'heure, 55-089, Victor Campenars, recordman du monde de l'heure, à la tête de l'équipe, il a été champion du monde. Il a gagné 4 fois l'Amstel, 2 fois le Tour de Lombardie, 2 fois également Paris-Tours, Paris-Roubaix, le Tour des Flandres. C'est un poste également dans la Flèche Wallonne, dans Liège-Bastogne-Liège, avec des maillots jaunes du Tour. Il effectue sa 20e saison dans le peloton professionnel. L'ovation à Philippe Gilbert. Philippe Gilbert, au départ avec Campenars, avec Van Moor, avec Arnaud Dely, avec Frédéric Frison, avec Vermersch, avec Valens. À tout à l'heure pour le champagne.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much indeed to our longtime sponsor, Science and Sport. We're very grateful to them for their support. You can, of course, still use the discount code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com to get your 25% off. But you may want to head over to Science and Sport and get even bigger discounts, because they're offering 30 or 40%, even up to 40% off all products at the moment. Go to scienceandsport.com and... yeah, huge discounts at the moment at Science and Sport if you want to stock up, as I have just done. I've just placed a large order for my Science and Sport products to help me, fuel me through the next few weeks and months of cycling. Now, I mentioned at the start the news that Netflix are giving cycling the Drive to Survive treatment. This has been the phenomenally popular, successful and very watchable series covering Formula One. We actually knew about this during last year's Tour de France, and in fact mentioned it in an episode of Kilometre Zero that we did about cycling films and cycling on film. It just shows you, if you listen to the cycling podcast, you get the news without even knowing it's the news. I understand that ASO have actually engaged the same production company, Box to Box Films, who are here at the Tour this year, with a view to making an equivalent in cycling. The one problem with that is that it would need the teams on board, and there's always this tension between ASO, the teams, and the UCI about basically who gets any money from projects like that. So there we were, Lionel, last July, somewhere in France, dropping the news that Netflix were there at the Tour last year. I was sceptical about whether this project would come off, because there have always been problems between ASO and the teams about who owns what and who gets the profits. But I'm quite glad and, well, very happy to see that there's been an appreciation here of the bigger picture. And if the new Netflix series on cycling can do for cycling what Drive to Survive has done for F1, then I think everyone's a winner. 8 teams have apparently signed up to the project. Filming has started already, although the series will focus entirely really on the Tour de France, but Netflix have been filming with the teams since the Tour de France presentation last year. They're going to be doing a lot at the Dauphiné on the eve of the Tour. The 8 teams involved are Jumbo-Visma, EF Education EasyPost, Quickstep Alpha Vinyl, Groupama FDG, Ineos Grenadiers, AG2R Citroën, Alpecin Fenix, and Movistar. No surprise to see a couple of French teams in there, of course. It's a good selection of teams. Some people complaining that UAE Team Emirates declined the opportunity. They, of course, have the defending champion, Tadej Pogacar. I don't think that's a problem. It's certainly not a problem on Drive to Survive when Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton are not involved. The way that series works is that each episode tends to focus on one particular storyline. So it's not, you're not really, you might not be aware of who's won the Drivers' Championship, but it does a really good job of bringing out the personalities, the humanity, bringing the sport to life. And like I say, I think it's a very positive thing. If it's as good as it could be. I spoke to one of the teams involved, EF Education Easy Post, their sports director, Tom Southam, the other day at Paris Nice. We'll hear from Tom just now, and then we'll hear from Owain Dool, a new rider for them. He's joined from Ineos Grenadiers. A few of Owain's thoughts, and he's ridden very well actually this week, on the Netflix project, and also how he's settling in to his new team. So here they are, Tom Southam and Owain Dool.
Are you a fan of Drive to Survive?
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. I think it's that's a great documentary. It's got really good, it's just human narrative, isn't it? Which puts, like, makes the sport more interesting. Like a lot of people, a lot of my friends, Formula One, watched it when I was a kid, went off it, and now, like, you know, a bit of internal conflict, a bit of, human drama. It's good.
Do you think cycling has those same ingredients and personalities?
I was thinking about this the other day. The thing that's really good in Formula One is the fact that the person you race against is in the same car as you, because the equipment's exactly the same. Cycling's got a lot of, like, rivalries, but it's quite a lot. It's more complicated, and there's a lot more sort of narratives going on. It does have it, in short, but they're more complicated. So I don't know whether they're going to try and narrow it down and have, like, focus on a few of those, or spread it out and try and really deeply explain how all these sort of things work. But it's got it in abundance, right?
I wonder. I mean, some of the drivers, especially like Daniel Ricciardo, you know, real big personalities, and he sort of carried that at first, I think, Drive to Survive. Who are the big personalities in cycling potentially?
Well, they're all in our team. Just 31 of the biggest personalities in cycling. I think cyclists have struggled recently a little bit with not actually getting their personalities out a lot, you know, and because a lot of teams are quite sort of regimented in the answers you can give, and I mean, nobody ever wants someone to say, oh, well, like my car was shit or my bike was shit, you know, like. But I think personalities will hopefully come out more. Not so much about, you know, your equipment or your team, but just people's general background will come out more. Because people don't often say a lot in interviews, do they? They say, yeah, I'm happy with my teammates, it was great. I won, I lost. I'm not upset, I'm happy, there's more to life. You know, it's all the same sort of crap. So it would be nice to go a bit deeper. And
Your team's been reported as one of the teams involved. No, you can't confirm that, but how do you think the riders and the staff will feel having apparently two Netflix people with each team, embedded with each team throughout the tour?
That's another thing I wondered about. It's like, do people start acting up? Are there certain people that want to, you know, advance their own thing? Are they going to behave differently? You'd hope not. And I think the tour's, like, especially around the tour, it's so hard. I don't think there's much room for that, you know, kind of manoeuvring and stuff. So I mean, you see pretty quickly people get, because we've always got cameras on the bus, we've always got people around asking questions. And I mean, I think once someone's around for a couple of days and people start to get a bit tired, they're just going to be themselves, aren't they? There isn't really the room to do that.
One final thing, I guess a lot of the riders will have watched Drive to Survive and enjoyed it. Do you think a lot of them will feel that, see the opportunity that's there for the sport to reach a new audience, which is in everyone involved in cycling's interests, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're clued up. They all get it. And they stand to gain a lot. I think the key thing for me is like, you know, kind of everyone understanding it is for all of us, as opposed to like, oh, let's try and make ourselves get that next sponsor or ourselves get that next thing. It's like, okay, if there's a bigger pot for everyone, then, you know, there isn't teams languishing with smaller sponsors, and people do, you know, because there's 18, there's 20 teams, spread it out, everyone gets better, conditions improve all around. So that's what I think everyone would like to see. I think you see that a lot in Formula One, you know, where the teams communicate a lot, and they're working to get the brand of the sport out there. And you kind of, I picked up on that from the documentary, and I'd like to see. I mean, cycling's never been like that. You know, you're basically trying to flick everyone, aren't you? You know, it's it, like in everything, the parking spot at the hotel and this and that. And it would be nice if we didn't all.
It's kind of the whole point of road racing, in a way, though, isn't it? I mean, that's what road racing is all about. It's so embedded in the sport.
I mean, it's so deeply inside all of us, you know, that you see people do it almost without thinking, because a lot of people are ex-riders themselves, and they all have this mentality of like, no, I'm just going to push you back and I'm going to go forward. But I think as more people are coming into the sport and the sport gets bigger, you know, like people come from those other like franchise sports and people start looking at it, then it does change, and we get out of that kind of stamping, you know, treading on other people mentality. Maybe
this Netflix could be the key to unlock that change in mentality.
Maybe I'm dreaming.
I've asked a few people this, but are you a Drive to Survive fan?
I am, yeah.
So are you excited by the news that cycling is getting similar treatment?
I think it's great. I think I'm a big Drive to Survive fan, and from what I can understand, it's been done by the same company, Box to Box. And I think what they did for F1, if they can do that for cycling, will be unbelievable. You know, my brother hated F1. I said, oh, you should watch this documentary. And he watched it and he's obsessed with F1 now. And, you know, if they can do the same for cycling, I think it'd be amazing.
Extra incentive to make the Tour de France team.
Yeah, potentially, yeah. Get Netflix famous.
And how are you settling into the team? It's a complete change for you, I guess, after quite a lot of years. You know, British Cycling and then Team Sky, Team Ineos. How are you finding the new environment?
I'm really enjoying it, I've got to be honest. I think with Ineos, and like you said before that, with British Cycling, I was very comfortable. I kind of knew the system, and I wouldn't say I was in a rut, but I think I just kind of reached what I could do in that team with the riders around. You know, it's a stacked team, so for me to get opportunities and was always going to be difficult. Whereas here, yeah, I have a lot more freedom. I feel there's a lot more belief in me as a rider as well, which is nice. And I think that's, for me, something I strive off. And yeah, I just want to kind of have the best year possible and kind of repay the faith the team have showed in me and in signing me and giving me these chances.
Classics the main focus for you?
Classics, yeah. So, and again, differently from previous years with Ineos, you know, I'd never done a Paris-Nice or a Tirreno. And I felt I could always be good at opening weekend, but then by the time the main classes came around, I kind of either stayed the same or dropped down a little bit, and everyone else raised their game. Whereas this year, yeah, I do Paris-Nice, and yeah, it's just that it's nice knowing your whole race program up to quite far ahead, so you can actually plan and think in your head what you need to do to be good there, instead of kind of almost feeling like you have to perform in every race just to get into the next race. So yeah, it's more relaxed, but I think it suits me a bit more.
Well, we heard from Owain Doolan there, and before that, Tom Southam. Very interesting from Owain about the sort of opportunities he's getting at his new team. He's never ridden Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico before, which is amazing, really. But they were talking as well about the new Netflix project. What are your thoughts on that, Lionel? You excited?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I'm not a Formula One fan, and I've given Drive to Survive a go, and I definitely get what you said about you kind of see past the car driving, and it's about the storylines and the personalities and the people, isn't it? And you do get a greater understanding of the sport, and I think that there's great potential for cycling and the Tour de France, and for all of us who follow the races, really, to learn a bit more about the people involved. What I do think is that there must be some teams that haven't been selected who are not all that happy at being excluded.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Matt White quite openly, I mean, they kind of pioneered the behind the scenes videos, didn't they, with Backstage Pass, and they were very keen to be involved. I understand Trek Segafredo also keen to be involved, and so I think, yeah, UAE Team Emirates declined the opportunity, but there are others who are not involved who would really have loved to be involved.
Well, it's an enormous shop window for the teams and the sponsors, isn't it? You know, Netflix is obviously a global media phenomenon, and, you know, people will sign up, cycling fans may sign up for Netflix to watch the documentary, and people who perhaps have a passing interest in cycling the way that I have, well, I really have no interest in Formula One, but I still watch Drive to Survive on your recommendation, Richard, and didn't regret doing so because I enjoyed it. I think, you know, it's a kind of a big moment, I think, for cycling and the Tour de France. It puts the sport in front of some different people. And if the goal is to broaden its appeal and demystify a bit and put some personality behind the sunglasses and under the helmets, this could surely help.
Definitely. And I can see some of the reservations or the skepticism that some people have. And, you know, with Formula One, there have been suspicions that some of the decisions taken have been with at least half an eye on the Netflix series. And you wonder about, you know, Quickstep Alpha Vinyl have got this dilemma. I don't think it's much of a dilemma at the moment. Jakobsen and Cavendish, you know, if you were Netflix and you were putting some pressure on and maybe offering some money, although not enough for Patrick Lefebvre, he's already said that he's signed up for this time but wouldn't do it for so little money again. But you could see that there could be pressure to have one rather than the other. I'm not saying that pressure would be significant or, you know, change anything. I don't suppose it would, but that's the fear that some people have. I should say as well that the Netflix treatment is being given apparently to tennis and golf as well, so it's not just cycling. And you do, I do worry a little that it could be diluted. I mean, there are other sports series. Amazon do All or Nothing, and I watched the first couple of those, and there are just so many now that I've kind of lost track. The novelty has kind of gone for me with that series. But you know, it's the same production company, Box to Box Films, and they've made other great sports films as well, notably Senna. So you know, they've got a great track record, and it's going to be a proper, you know, two people from Netflix, presumably sound and film people in each team. So it's going to be done properly, and very much looking forward to seeing the results of that, which I guess wouldn't be before next year.
Maybe we should get our lawyers onto the teams that weren't selected and do an audio version for the other teams.
Get our lawyers, or just ask them ourselves.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to make
the
it,
other problem being that we don't have lawyers.
We don't have lawyers. We certainly don't. Hopefully we don't need them.
Lionel, any update on the Roland Cassellet prize? I mean, a lot of calls for Tadej Pogacar to be awarded it already, given his performance at Strade Bianche.
I mean, surely the new leader, I mean, has to be said, that was the most impressive performance of the season so far. But watching the first stage of Paris-Nice, I thought maybe there should be a team prize now. I don't know, maybe a sort of an extra team large Cassellet bowl for the team of the year. I don't know. But I think, yeah, Tadej Pogacar's
win. No, I think it's an individual.
On Saturday, it was, the performance of the season so far, and will take some beating, I think. But still, Strade Bianche is still not a monument.
You're really trying hard with that pronunciation now, aren't you?
I'm trying
Lizzie
hard
Banks
with
is
the pronunciation,
really...
yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Lizzie Banks is going to have a very, very long night correcting all my errors in podcasts otherwise. So, yeah, I think that, you know, it's not a monument. It's not over 200 kilometres. It's not in the middle of a grand tour going over all big mountains. There's still plenty of scope for somebody to topple that performance this season. But, you know, as we stand today, I think that's the best ride of the year so far. So we have a new leader.
Congratulations, Tadej. Before we go on to the more serious subject that you mentioned at the start, Lionel, of how events in Ukraine are impacting on the world of cycling, can I give another quick plug to the event I'm doing at the Tour of Flanders? The Flandrian Hotel are hosting me and guests for Tour of Flanders weekend. If you want to come and ride your bike and hear some talky type events in the evening, from me and perhaps others as well, go to flandrianhotel.com, Flandrien hotel.com, and you'll find details there about how to sign up. I'm looking forward to it.
Before we go, as I mentioned at the start in the news roundup, the sporting implications of the Russian invasion of Ukraine is one thing. Gazprom being suspended, they'd wanted to ride Trofeo Laguilia in white jerseys to promote a peaceful message, but the team has been suspended because all Russian and Belarusian squads are suspended from competition and no events will be held in those countries until further notice. The next major international event to be held in either Russia or Belarus really is the European Track Championships, are due to be held in Tula in Russia next year. Gazprom's team manager Reinhard Kamidulin said that the team has until the end of the month to save itself with an alternative sponsor. And he does point out that the team is based in Italy, the management company is based in Switzerland, and the sponsor is Gazprom's German arm. So, the situation, even with regards to Gazprom, is not perhaps as simple and uncomplicated as the sanction suggests. The UCI and the European Cycling Union both have Russian, and in the case of the European Cycling Union, Belarusian people on their management committees. And British Cycling has sort of taken a lead. Frank Slevin, the chair of British Cycling, wrote to both the UCI and the European Cycling Union saying that Belarusian and Russian members of the management board and management committee should be suspended for the time being on the basis that sanctioning the athletes can't be right if the administrators are allowed to carry on as normal. Now, on the European Cycling Union, the vice president, Alexander Guzyatnikov, who is Russian, and management board member Natalia Silinskaya, who people will probably remember as a former track sprinter, a Belarusian, they both withdrew themselves from the weekend's Congress meeting. British Cycling actually didn't attend that meeting. And so there is a sort of, I guess, a political standoff here. The Scandinavian countries plus Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Belgium, Netherlands and Poland have all written to the European Cycling Union president to ask them to suspend the Russians and Belarusians from the management board on the basis, I think, that whilst withdrawing themselves voluntarily is probably the right thing to do in the circumstances, it leaves grey areas. You know, when do they decide to come back, or does the cycling union decide to come back? And in the case of the UCI, Igor Makarov, who has been a big figure in the UCI for a decade, he is Russian, he's an oligarch, he supported both Brian Cookson and the current president David Lapartion in their bids to become UCI president, and he's a member of the management committee. I understand that British Cycling have had a response from the UCI president saying that the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, hasn't recommended that members be removed from management committees because they're Russian or Belarusian. And I suppose that raises the question of, you know, who is making the decisions for the UCI? Is it the UCI or is it the IOC? Or do all of the sports governing bodies across all sports need to come together and have one consistent line when it comes to administrators, companies, events, sponsors, so that there isn't a sort of difference between, you know, I don't know, cycling and football and sailing or whatever, the gymnastics, whatever the sports happen to be. So a very unfortunate situation, and it does have implications for sport.
Well, Lionel, we should wrap things up for this week, a week where we've released two episodes. We also released the latest episode of Cycling Podcast Femina last week, covering the sort of opening races in Belgium. Lots of interviews there as well with the likes of Emma Norsgaard, Annemiek van Vleuten, Demi Vollering and others. We are, and as I said earlier, we're launching our new Arrivé show next week, which should come out as soon after Milan-San Remo as we can get it out. A bit like on a grand tour where the episode comes out in the evening with pretty quick reaction, analysis, discussion. So look out for that next week, and we'll be repeating that throughout the spring.
And if you are looking for something else to listen to and you're a friend of the podcast, Paris-Nice is on this week. You may not have heard the episode I made last year about kind of the origins and history of Paris-Nice and Sean Kelly's seven-year winning streak in the 1980s. It's called Paris-Nice and the King, I think, is the title of the episode. But it's on Friends of the Podcast feed now, along with, what, 50 or so more episodes. So if you are a friend of the podcast and you haven't worked your way through the back catalogue, that would probably be an appropriate one to have a listen to this week.
Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com and keep your emails coming. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. We've been getting a lot of correspondence recently and we read it all. Sorry we don't read it all out on the show, but we try to respond to all the emails at least. So thanks very much for Lionel acknowledges that we do try, don't we, Lionel?
We do try. Yeah, it can be tricky when we're away traveling or what have you. But I wonder whether we should do a sort of emails episode, a bit like a press conference, because people who send in emails, it's different to an actual question, isn't it? They're often making interesting points that are relevant to our coverage, but also the sport in general. So maybe that's something we'll look at.
Indeed. Yeah, well, thanks for all the emails. We really appreciate you getting in touch. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with Daniel again, looking back at Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico and goodness knows what else. So thanks very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Adam Bowie.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.